you all for coming. Mm-hmm. And just a very brief introduction. I'm Martha Munson-Lau, known usually at home as Marty. My husband, George Lau. And we have spent over 6 months in the Holy Land. Last fall, we were in Bethlehem for 3 months. And the fall before that, we were in Jerusalem. And George's first trip was at the beginning of 2014. My first trip was in 1966 when I actually went to Jordan then. It was before the Six-Day War. So, and I came from Libya. So, for me, it was fortunate that we could go to Jordan because the next summer it became Israel then, and I was would not have been allowed to come from Libya. So, we're going to take you on a little tour of the faces, the people, our experiences. Experiences that our friends had, and tell you a little bit about our lives there, their lives there. So we're going to begin, and feel free to sit where you are or follow around, and I'll be talking about different things. So,
and how many have you been to the Holy Land? How many of you have you Yeah, lots of people.
Yep.
Was on my list of things to do, but now I can't wait to go back. So it's a great place.
So, so this is what we saw and what we experienced. We're going to start in Bethlehem. So these two walls here are all people and places in Bethlehem, from Bethlehem. We're going to start with Banksy, and he's a famous artist who has done different art projects around the world, but he has painted on the wall. And the sign says, "Welcome to Palestine, welcome to Bethlehem." And it's the piece with the crosshairs on, you know, he is being targeted. We went and we had connections both times with the Lutheran Church. And so this is Christmas Eve in Bethlehem. We spent the last two Christmases in Bethlehem. This is the Lutheran bishop, and his name is Muni Yunan. He's also the head of the Lutheran World Federation for the World itself. Next is Pastor Mitri Rahab, and he is the pastor of Christmas Lutheran Church. There are Christians. Many Christians in Palestine, although the population is going down, unfortunately. Life is too hard and people are leaving. He wrote Bethlehem Besieged, which is on the table. He's written quite a few books. But that's one of my favorites of his. He talks about the siege and the incursion in 2002 into Bethlehem in that book and all of his experiences. So this is the Lutheran Church, Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem. He is preaching. The congregation is there. The hymnals, it's wonderful to go into a church, and there are the hymnals and the Bible, and they're all in Arabic. And we're singing songs together, we're singing in English, and then you get to the Alleluia, for example, and everyone sings together. So it's wonderful. We had, this is the family of our landlord. This is our landlord, Sammy, and his daughter, Natalie, who is this stunning girl, his wife, Juliana, and then their other daughter, Talene. And so we lived in their house. We had a separate apartment. But he also worked for the school that George is going to tell you about, Dar al-Kalama. They shared many stories with us. One was that she has a Jerusalem ID, but he does not. So what? Well, there it matters a great deal because he has to have permission and a special permit to go and live with his wife in Jerusalem. They actually operate two separate, they have two separate households. Before we came in October, the kids were still going through the checkpoint every day to come to Bethlehem to go to school. And their parents just decided it was too dangerous, it was too difficult. They didn't want to subject their children to this treatment. And so then they were all staying in Bethlehem, which has its own issues. But they had to maintain these two separate households. So it's difficult. Especially George, I picked a little bit. They have several olive trees in around their yard, and so we picked olives together. And then it was a great time. We took all the olives to the factory, and here their olive oil is coming out. So, and then we got to eat it, which was incredible. So these people face a lot of difficulties. Bethlehem is 5-6 miles from Jerusalem. And so you know how you run from one place to another. No big deal, you jump in your car. But for those of you coming in, we're serving mint tea. Go ahead and Bart will serve you. However, Bethlehem might as well be a million miles away if you're a Palestinian living in the West Bank, living in Bethlehem, because you have to have a permit to go to Jerusalem. Even though it's your holy city, you're a resident, you've lived there all of your life, you have to get a permit from the Israelis in order to go there. So we talked to many Bethlehemites who hadn't been to Jerusalem in years, 10, 12, 15 years.
Is it difficult to get that permit?
It's very difficult to get the permit. Going back to, for example, Mitri Rahab, I was at their house Easter of 2004, and I overheard that his wife was still in mourning because he had recently died. So, or her father had recently died. So anyway, then a few months later, the book came out, Bethlehem Besieged, and I'm reading along, and I get to this chapter, and it explains his father-in-law having chest pains, going to the checkpoint to get to the hospital in Jerusalem, and his permit, he had a permit, but his permit said it was for business. And the soldier said, the Israeli soldier said, you're not going for business. You're not allowed. And so it took several more hours and several more checkpoints before they could get him to the hospital, and it was too late. So, yes, it's difficult, and if you have a permit, it may not get you there, unfortunately.
Yeah, permit. You might. It's kind of like getting a driver's license every few months. You have to go to the courthouse, sort of like, and apply and pay money. And then the permit will say, okay, on August 18th at 2 p.m., you can go to the checkpoint. But if you're delayed and you don't make it at 2 o'clock on that day, that's too bad. You can't go through. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how it is.
But it's
so specific.
You're comparing it to a driver's license, but it's not as easy to get as a driver's license. So it's much harder. These lovely welcome signs are now all over the West Bank, going into Bethlehem, going into Hebron, going into Ramallah. It says, this road leads to Area A under the Palestinian Authority. The entrance for Israeli citizens is forbidden, dangerous to your lives, and is against the Israeli law. So it's a very specific, you have to stay here, and you have to stay here. Don't talk to each other, and be afraid. This sign didn't exist 10 years ago, 8 years ago. But when we went 2 years ago, there they were all over the place. And you can see how tall it is. I'm up there in the sun. Asim is an awesome guy. He is wonderful. From Bethlehem. Rolf?
Yeah.
You've got your keffiyeh. The keffiyeh, I bought many keffiyehs, and they are from Asim. So he's a Palestinian shopkeeper in Bethlehem, very close to Nativity, or to Major Square. And, we spent many, many hours with him. But one of our, not our first encounter, but one of our initial encounters, we had bought quite a few things from him. Well, they never arrived, and there was a whole story behind that. But when we came to pick them up again, he said, well, where are you staying? Oh, and we said, Mount of Olives. He said, well, I'll take you. But come to find out, we were staying on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem, just 5-6 miles away. But he can't get there. He thought we were staying at the Mount of Olives Hotel in Bethlehem. So when we discovered that, he took us instead to the bus stop to take us to Jerusalem, and he said, and he handed us a 200 shekel bill and said, you know, you might need this to get home. Well, that's 50 bucks. Wow. So giving a stranger 50 bucks to, and pay me back later. I mean, you know, we could have not shown up, but that's the kind of generosity that we continue to experience, which was wonderful. The reason that these people can't go anywhere right now is the 26-foot-high apartheid wall that runs theoretically down the Green Line between the West Bank and Israel, but in fact it does not. 85% of it goes into Palestinian territory. So people say that it was built for security, but it's really built as a land grab. So this is in Bethlehem. We experienced all kinds of things here. You can see the wall again. And this was one of my favorite paintings, I guess. Christmas is imprisoned by this wall. So the Christmas tree right there. The wall is very daunting. You can see by the size of the cars that how tall it is. The guard towers are every so many hundred feet.
When was it built?
It started being built in 2002. It was deemed illegal by the International Court in 2004.
It hasn't come down.
It has not come down. They continue to add on to it. It's going to, when it's completed, it'll be over 400 miles long.
Great wall.
Wow. It's a long, long, long wall. So in order to get in and out of Bethlehem for everyone, now the wall is on three sides of Bethlehem, and the fourth side is an Israeli-only road. So if you live in Bethlehem as a Palestinian, and you look at this wonderful four-lane highway, you can look at it, but you can't drive on it unless you have a permit. Now, even if you don't have a permit, you can't drive on it. So you can go through Checkpoint 300, which to me is like going through a... It's like cattle going to slaughter is the feeling that you get as you go through this area. Sometimes you're going through these and they will stop the turnstiles. And if you're caught in it, I mean, I witnessed children, them stopping and children being stuck in there. And when they're ready to turn it back on, then they do. But it's a very humiliating experience. With our American passports, we show it. It's not a big deal. But for the native population, the Palestinians, they're the ones who have difficulties. The other checkpoint going out of Bethlehem that we went to a lot was, it's called DCO. And we would go in and out with on the bus. So we took transportation everywhere. We didn't have a vehicle of our own. But if you're 50 or over, or if you're an international, you stay on the bus. The bus pulls over, and then all of the Palestinians 50 and under have to get off of the bus. They line up. The Israeli soldiers come and check the bus out, check our IDs, our passports, and then they check everyone's passport, or permit, I should say, to get back on the bus. Not everyone was allowed to get back on the bus. It just depended on what was going on that day. So it's just some of those stories. And this applies to Muslims, Christians, no distinction as far as if you're Palestinian, you're Palestinian. A few more from Bethlehem. This is Majdi, one of our favorite people. I've known him for 12 years. He was always helping us out and saving us, in a sense. But he was trying to run a business. And many, many, many afternoons, more than not each week, he would have tear gas in the street. Here are the protesters. And they're teenage kids, basically, and they have rocks. And you can see that some have keffiyehs on their head, or they're covered. And they're covered for a couple of reasons. One is so that they're not identified, but the other reason is tear gas. You want to protect yourself if there's tear gas. So we had just been close to Majdi's, and we were visiting an office, and they said, okay, things are ramping up, we've got to go. And so we walked down the street, went into this hotel. This is a 5-star hotel, the Jasser Palace Hotel. This is tear gas. So this is what was going on all the time. The tear gas canisters are from Pennsylvania. They're written on there. They're made in Pennsylvania. A sign of hope. This is Isa. He's a Palestinian Christian who works in Jerusalem. He has an ID to go there. And he is building his own house. So they're, they continue to live. They want a good life for themselves and their families. Another difficult situation. This is Claire Anastas. She's a Palestinian Christian, lives in Bethlehem, lived on the main street there between Jerusalem through Bethlehem to Hebron. That's where the Israelis built this 26-foot wall. And so her house, it's a dead-end street, and her house is surrounded on three sides by this wall. So it's pretty difficult. She has to obtain a permit to go on her roof, if you can imagine. Tent of Nations, I talked about a little bit during one of the first words. But the Tent of Nations is a little farm outside of Bethlehem in Nahalin. There are two brothers. There's Daoud and Daher. That's Gian, his wife. But it's a little farm and family who have owned their farm for 100 years. And it's prime property, and the Israelis would really like it. It's surrounded by 5 settlements. But their motto is, we refuse to be enemies. They want to work within the system. They want to be neighbors to their Israeli neighbors. But the Israelis have cut their water off. They've cut their electricity. They have blocked their road to them. But they continue to be steadfast. We planted olive trees in memory of my mom at this farm. So special to me. Mm-hmm. So, George is going to talk about the two schools that we were at.
Really quickly, I was curious, when you talk about, like, people, like, not being allowed on the bus because they're Palestinian or whatever, because of all this identity, this might just be ignorance, but is Palestinian a geographic or ethnic distinction among people?
Good question.
Yeah.
Yes.
Here's a map, and if you can get find time to look at it more closely, but this is Palestine, and there are like 130 countries now in the world that are recognizing Palestine as a state. And so what's left of it, this was created, there's a green line, and that's what this light is about, the green line, which was the armistice line that was determined in 1949 by the UN to say this is the border, the boundary between the new state of Israel and what was left of Palestine, I think like 20%, or actually originally it was 45%, but it's been pared down, as you can see. All that's left of Palestine are these little yellow spots. Israel has total control over all this blue stuff. The Oslo Accords gave Israel control over all of Palestine, areas A, B, and C. And area A is supposed to be under full Palestinian authority, but Israelis can come and go anytime when they want. So they occupy this, they call it disputed territories. We hear on the news disputed territories, and then maybe on other kinds of news it's called the State of Palestine. So it depends on how you hear it. There's lots of different words that if you pay attention to on the news, it's like, what kind of news are you listening to? But anyway, so this is kind of the answer to you. It's, they're Palestinians. They're both Christians, Muslims. There are Jewish Palestinians, actually. Not very many, but it's hard for them to be there. But it's a mix of Arabic-speaking people from all over the world, really. And they have inhabited Palestine for thousands of years. They were the first Christians, actually. The Palestinians rolled away the stone to the empty tomb, basically. They were the first Christians. So anyway, if you could look at this map more closely later on, it's a UN map. It's 2 years old. It's pretty current. And it's fascinating to see. It's a fascinating place in the world. And I don't know how many of you are Lutherans, but the Lutheran Church is doing some amazing things in Palestine. There are no Lutheran churches in Israel. There's one Lutheran church in the Old City, which is East Jerusalem, which is kind of under Israel's jurisdiction. But the Lutheran Church is in Palestine, serving Palestinians. And that's an important thing to kind of keep in mind, that, wow, really, the Lutheran Church is, and the other Christian church, actually, Christians are kind of like the glue that could maybe help resolve this dilemma that's there. And so the governments keep, you know, they have their own interests, but the churches might be the solution to creating some better situation there. And the whole world depends on that part of the world calming down and having some justice, which will bring peace. We can talk about peace all we want, but until there's justice, then that's what will change. Is there has to be some real compromising that happens. Anyway, I'll kind of go through some of these pictures. I had the great fortune of, well, firstly, we're sponsoring a Palestinian student that was going to school at Luther College, and he finally got married and invited us to his wedding in Ramallah, so I got to go. We all went to visit for 3 weeks. We went to his wedding, and then the very first day we were there, I got invited to teach at Muslim World Federation School in Beit Hanina, which are these photographs. So that was my first experience. We lived at the Augusta Victoria Complex on the Mount of Olives. It's the coolest place in the world to live. I wake up every morning, and there's the Dead Sea, the sunrise over the Dead Sea, and the wilderness. Oh, it's just glorious. You look the other way, there's the Old City and the Dome of the Rock. It's just such a beautiful place to be. They've got 800 olive trees, so it's a walled complex. It's just gorgeous. You can stay there $56 a night for a double room. It's just such a deal. And there's lots of rooms, and it's a really good time to visit the Holy Land, because we were practically the only American tourists around, and we felt like we were noticed and we were important. And
no lines, and really good time. No, cheap rates. Anyway, so these are pictures from a year ago. Ruba and Wallet. The school was about 60 years old, and it served as like a two-year vocational training school, and they started a new program in ceramics trying to attract women students. So I had all women students. Mostly I had 12 students, but it was a new program, and it was very difficult. A lot of them couldn't come to class because of one reason or another. They had some riots in their town, and the town was sealed off. They couldn't come to school. At least one or two days a week, they would miss school because of some incursion that was happening in their neighborhoods. Some of these students, Ruba, she's just a sweet girl. This gal here, Wallet, still kind of Facebook with her. She kind of keep track of her. Her brother was murdered by Israeli police. He was a taxi driver. He was shot and killed. He was driving by the old city. And then her father committed suicide. He was so distraught that he couldn't handle it. And she was suicidal. And
and so her, she found
her doctor said, you should take this pottery class.
And so it was wonderful to have her as a student. We love her. She's had us to her house many times, and we talk on Facebook. But she's just one student who she excelled. She blossomed in this whole situation. And now she is at school, and she's posting pictures of the work that she does.
Yeah, so she's making pottery and selling, so she's a success. And little Renna, she's teaching now, I think, at another school. And this is Peter. He drove me every day. I got a ride back and forth to school. And he's a Christian and would sing, teach me all kinds of songs. Anyway, just really fun. And here's the school guards and one of the faculty. But there's two. This is a Muslim. Amir, and then George, and two Georges, and then Sabina. Anyway, but two Christians and two Muslims, you would never know the difference. They just are, they're together, they work together, they play together. So you never know the difference. Anyway, and then the director of the school on the last photograph is Yusuf Solomon, and he lived in Jericho, and it was really a struggle for him to get to school every day because he had to go to a certain checkpoint, leave his car, and then get a taxi the rest of the way. He couldn't drive the whole way to school. But that was a pretty unique experience. They taught welding and car repair and electronics, different kinds of things that like a two-year vocational training school would do. And then this past year, I got invited to teach at Dar el-Kalam University College in Bethlehem. So it's quite a contrast between East Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And it's a state-of-the-art facility. It's just brand new. It was built by Mitri Rahab, the pastor of Christmas Lutheran Church. It's a brand new school. It's state-of-the-art, real modern. 800 students that are all art majors. It's a four-year accredited liberal arts degree. And so the students were both Muslims with a hijab, and without the hijab, they're Christians. I didn't really talk about that, but you could tell by their names what their background was. Here's the Khadr, who's Christian, and Muhammad, who's Muslim, and they're just the best of friends. I really recommend the experience for just about anybody to go there and meet the people that are there. So just really real people. This gal here, Barbara, she's from Belarus and married a Palestinian doctor who's a neurologist. And this is a piece, it's a Christmas ornament she made out of tear gas canisters. Her husband, so there's this wall I already mentioned. Her husband diagnosed this one woman was, she couldn't walk anymore. She had five children, and she just couldn't hardly walk at all. And the doctors didn't know what was wrong with her. And her husband diagnosed her with a vitamin D deficiency because she
wasn't getting enough sun. She was in the shadow of the wall. They gave her high doses of vitamin D, and within a few weeks, she was walking again.
It's still in the shadow of the wall.
Yes.
The hijab doesn't help either, actually. The hijab's got lots of different social reasons for that. Mary, the Virgin Mary, wore a hijab before the Muslim religion was created. The hijab was worn, so it's not like they developed it or invented it, but it's a sign of that you're a faithful Muslim, and also that you're not just a piece of, you know, you're not going to be eyed like by men and think that you're an easy person to have. It sort of is a sign of modesty, and they would begin to appreciate the way, and they would fashion it in such beautiful ways. So it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. This guy Dia, he lives in the Haitian refugee camp, which is right beside the school. The Haitian refugee camp that started in 1948, after the Israel was created, and 12 years. His brother had been in prison for 12 years. He hadn't seen his brother for 12 years because he was caught throwing stones and also a Molotov cocktail. So that's kind of bad. But 12 years in prison. They demolished the family home 3 months after he left prison. They came and demolished the house as a form of punishment to families who had nothing to do with the crime, but that's what Israel does, is demolishes homes as a form of punishment. And some of our students here were on a field trip to the Dead Sea. It's kind of fun. And one of the students, Barbara, had a nice home in Jericho. It's pretty cool. Think about Jesus being in the wilderness. In the wilderness, you can see the wilderness is about 30 miles across and about 40 miles wide. And there's all kinds of Bedouins that live in the wilderness. So Jesus in the wilderness, I feel differently about that now because he wasn't alone. There are all kinds of people that live there. And so, that's where we were, was in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there's these students and everyone's got stories of their houses being demolished or something. One student's like, when I think about, I taught at Luther College, and think about some of the troubles the students would complain about, they're just pale in comparison to, just for these kids to get to school, sometimes it would take 3 hours to get to school and back. This gal, she lived in Ramallah, so she had to go from Bethlehem through the wall, through East Jerusalem, and back to another wall to get into Ramallah, and they would open her. One time she said she had two young children in the car and the soldiers were swearing at her children. She said, "Don't talk to my children that way." And then they maced her and made her get out of the car. For 6 hours they made her stand outside of her car and try to get her to sign a thing saying she was attacking the soldiers. Her husband, being a doctor, was able to contact a lawyer, and finally at the end of the day they got it straightened out. But if she had been arrested, she would have had to have been out of the country and leave her family. That was just a daily thing, and sometimes she would talk about driving by the elementary school in Bethlehem, Beit Sahor, and it's a beautiful day, but they were tear gassing the school, so she had to roll the windows back up because Israelis would tear gas the kids going to school almost every day. Just incredible stories. One student in this picture here, photography major, he comes from Hebron. Sometimes it takes him 3 hours. He always comes to class late.
Explain how far away it is.
It's about 18 miles away, Hebron.
Usually it takes half hour.
Anyway, and he's a photography major. He just got this beautiful, expensive camera, and coming through the checkpoint, it just smashed it on the ground. And he was like, "Yeah, they broke my camera today." You know, and it's like, he just, life goes on. And yeah. He's not going to stew about it all day, but that happened to a student at Luther College. The police would be involved in all kinds of, you know, but just these kids there, school is the most important thing that they can do. I had some of the students who were lawyers or doctors, teachers, and that's what they can do, is go to school and learn more things. So that's the most valuable thing they have. And for one example was a neighbor that we had living near us. Israelis will hire Palestinian doctors because they're superior. The competition for school is so great that to get through school and be successful as a doctor is just incredible, more difficult than here in this country. So they're just superb physicians. Palestinian doctors are superb. Anyway, and then...
India from Dehesha is also our kind of our poster boy here at the front door, so I just wanted to make that connection. A few more places. I just have a little bit of Hebron, which George just mentioned. Hebron is a really difficult place for the Palestinians. But this is inside the Ibrahimi Mosque, which is a beautiful place. And this is where Abraham is buried. Important to all three faiths. Now part of the mosque is taken over and has become a synagogue, and that's a long story, but basically there was a massacre by actually an American Jew who came and shot and killed quite a few Palestinians.
36 people during prayer.
In the early 90s. And then as a result, they took over part of the synagogue. There are checkpoints all over the place in Hebron, in the old city, in the Palestinian area. Many of the kids, probably most of the kids, have to go through checkpoints in order to just get to school. So, just looking at this little boy, it's just, you know, hard to imagine what he has to go through each day. And then this picture just really thrills me because in sections of the town, they have sealed off the front doors of Palestinian homes. So they have to enter by the window. It's hard to believe. But
yeah, they weld the doors shut.
Yeah.
Why did they close the doors for that reason? What was it, were the rationale?
Security.
Isn't it because it's a so-called Israeli street in front?
And that's Shuhada Street. And they are not all on Shuhada, which is. Yes, Israeli but only. They have deemed it Israeli only.
That would be an example. It would be deemed an Israeli only street, so they just seal it off.
Well, Hebron's a city of about 250,000 people, or Palestinians. There's 250 Israeli settlers.
Now that's figures gone up to about 800.
About 800 settlers in a town of 250,000 Palestinians, and these 800 settlers rule the city. There's a couple thousand Israeli soldiers that protect them. And if there's any kind of problem, they'll just seal off more and more of the town and make it harder and harder. And they just hope that all the Palestinians will just leave.
I was hoping that you would say something about the role of the Christian Peacemaker Team in Hebron.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
There's a group called CPT, Christian Peacemaker Team. They're in a few places around the world, but they are in Hebron. It's a group of internationals who have come there and live there. Their motto is called Getting in the Way. And they often walk the children to school to protect them. They also, if they see a situation escalating, they actually step their body in between, if possible, and diffuse the situation. They don't say, you're right, you're wrong. They try to calm the situation down. They live right in the old city. Their street to Shuhada Street has now been blocked, so they have to go a long way around, but they live very simply in the old city. And they're there as a presence. We were in the middle of a tour with them several years ago, and we came upon a house that some other CPT people had actually were monitoring because the Israelis had gone into a Palestinian home. They were on the roof. They had their weapons. And so CPT is trying to
talk them up into coming out of the house for the Israeli soldiers to get them out of the house. But everything in a peaceful, nonviolent way. So.
Some of the students had little apps on their cell phones that would tell them to maybe avoid this street or that street,
yeah,
so they wouldn't be involved in some.
Yeah. Which is a new thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
They all had
yeah.
apps on.
Just like the traffic thing, but
yeah.
Yeah.
This,
yeah.
Police are here, and they
yeah.
go this other way.
Oh,
this checkpoint will take an hour to get through, so we'll drive another 15 minutes and go through a checkpoint. It only takes 30 minutes to get through.
And just a three pictures from Ramallah where our Palestinian son grew up and lived, got married, and so on. He's now in Kelmer, Iowa, which is right next to Decorah. Which so he's our good Muslim son going to this good Lutheran school. This is his mom, Fuad. So that means she's the mother of Fuad. And then her husband would be Abu Fuad, the father of Fuad, is the oldest son. So she has not been, she lives, you know, a few miles from Jerusalem. Ramallah is just north of Jerusalem. She hasn't been in years. She hasn't gotten a permit. The checkpoint right there, the guard tower and so on, that's Kalandia checkpoint. It's one of the most contentious and difficult checkpoints to go through. You often hear of shootings, killings, and so on. Okay, in the corner one is, again, another turnstile in the Kalandia checkpoint going into Jerusalem. And here we are in Jerusalem, Jump on the Rock, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And these are they're in the Old City, called the Haram al-Sharif, or the Temple Mount. The Haram al-Sharif is the noble sanctuary, is how it translates. But the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the third most holy site in Islam. One of our friends said, she said, if you pray at Al-Aqsa, it's like praying 1,000 times somewhere else. The prayers are so powerful. That's how she explained it to me. But especially, both times that we were there, but especially this fall, it was so difficult for people to be allowed to go to the mosque to pray, especially on Fridays. So the Israeli soldiers would set up these, they're called flying checkpoints, where they might not be there last night, but they're there today, there now. And so this Friday they would say, well, only men over 40 can go pray today, or only men over 50 can go pray today. The rules would change each week, so people didn't know what to expect. This is a peaceful protest. The men have taken their prayer rugs and they are praying in the street outside of the Damascus Gate, outside of the Old City, because they are not allowed. They have not been allowed. And there are soldiers with their rifles right in front of them. It doesn't happen with just the Muslims. It also happens with the Christians. They are not allowed sometimes to their holy sites as well. This is just an overall of Jerusalem. This is the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in the Old City. And then the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And then you have minarets of mosques around. And one of the most magnificent things is to hear the call to prayer and the church bells ringing at the same time. It's wonderful. Nedra, Christian Palestinian, invited us. We met her. She invited us to breakfast. Come to her house. She is a refugee. She was a young girl in 1948, and she said her family left. They lived west of Jerusalem somewhere, and she said they were terrified. There had just been a massacre, and they were terrified, and they left. So she has these childhood memories of this. This is her church that she took to, took us to. It's an Orthodox church right next to the Church of the... connected to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's one of the oldest...
Christian church in the world.
In the world.
Yeah, it's from the very first Pentecost. And it's been ever since. So.
It's an amazing place. And the story of Khalid, he works at the Mount of Olives at the Augusta Victoria. And so we were picking olives together. He lives in Bethany. If you're on the Mount of Olives, you look down, and there's Bethany, and then you turn around, and there's Jerusalem, and I mean, it's this magnificent place. So we were talking. He said, yes, he used to drive to work, and it would take about 10 minutes. Now his travel to work, to and from, takes an hour, at least an hour each way. He's no longer allowed to drive his vehicle to Jerusalem. He now has to have a work permit. He has to take two buses, go through a checkpoint, go through the wall, and finally arrive. So if you can imagine, you know, instead of 20 minutes out of your day getting to work, it's 2 hours. That's a lot of time and frustration. It would be for me. And then this last picture. We would run into these situations as we're walking down the street. This is in Jerusalem, near the Damascus Gate, where people would be randomly stopped and frisked. And the weapons are pointing at them, and they have to empty their pockets and so on. He emptied his pockets, and he had cigarettes.
Now, I've got pictures. His cell phone, his cigarettes, and sunglasses. That's all he had.
Yeah.
And then after I took these pictures, these guys wanted my camera. The soldiers started following me and wanted me to. I just pretended I was a tourist.
Intimidating. And I just wanted to mention my dress. And this is called a thobe. It's a Palestinian dress. It's quite used. This one in particular. It's not a new dress. It's kind of like, if you're familiar with the Norwegian...
Bunads.
It's kind of like bunads in that this region has this color and pattern, and this region is different. I love the Palestinian embroidery. So what I started doing is I started buying old pieces, just little pieces of the Palestinian embroidery, and now I'm starting to incorporate them with material from Damascus, Damascus silk is what it's called, and just playing with that. So that's what that's all about, and I have a couple of books for you to look at. And George is going to talk about
the
images on the floor.
So when I was at Darnell Campbell last fall, I was invited to be part of this installation class, or this class is on installation art, and so all my students were taking this other class, and using art as a form of peaceful protest. And so I would try to keep up with them because they, you know, under duress, you can come up with some amazingly creative things. I saw artwork from the end of the Soviet Union, and it was just some incredible things that artists did at that time. And maybe this is a similar time for Palestinians. Anyway, it's a little explanation of this. This is stones that found out from outside. The stones are the weapons for the young Palestinians. They're like Olympic quality stone throwers. But they are the best. It could be a competition. But so they throw stones. They're not allowed to have guns. Palestinians can't have guns. There are no tanks or planes in Palestine. They have a very small military that's not allowed to use bullets in their guns. They have to go to Turkey to practice shooting guns. Anyway, so the kids throw stones, and when we were there, we got there in early October, and it just started to escalate, ramped up really big time. And so from October until now, 250 Palestinians have been martyred or killed, mostly at checkpoints. So there's 250 stones to represent all those people, and some lots of children even. And we would see the news every day in Bethlehem, and there would be a bystander's video recording what would happen. And just, you wouldn't believe some of the situations that there were and how unfair it seems to be. Many, many times the Israeli IDF soldiers would shoot and kill somebody and then put a knife beside their body and say, they were trying to stab us. And the Israeli soldiers get no wounds or anything, but they shoot dead a small child because he had a broken ruler in his backpack. A woman standing there, they put a knife in her hand. She's going, no, no, don't shoot. They put a knife in her hand and then shoot her. So she's trying to stab us. So these are all videos that you can find online. And it's just like, when you see these, it's like, there's something going on that we don't see in our news here. So there's that part of going through checkpoints, and the young people are just so disillusioned with their a boss is no longer, the PA is no longer really in control of Palestine. It's not viable. And so the young people, half the population is young, and they're just rebellious, and they're tired, sick and tired of the situation. And then this other piece is about home demolition. One morning, and home demolition, so there's, since January this year, 600 Palestinian homes have been demolished.
Since January,
600 homes, and then there's usually 10 people in a house, so it's about 6,000 Palestinians so far this year. Since 1967, almost 50,000 homes have been destroyed, Palestinian homes. It happens every night. Part of the reason is the Palestinians don't have a proper permit. Or the Israelis will change the land and say, this is a military zone today, so you can't have your house here. Or this is a park. Suddenly, your land is going to become a park. We're going to build a settlement here, so you have to, your house can't be here. Maybe your child has threatened and stabbed a soldier or tried to, they demolish your house because your child has done something bad. So there's collective punishment. But so it costs about $25,000 to apply for a building permit. And last year, out of 5.5 million Palestinians, they granted one building permit. So you lose your $25,000. So most people just can't afford to apply for a building permit. So almost all the homes have demolition orders, sometimes for 10 years, maybe 20 years. The Israelis continue to collect your taxes. They love that. And then one day in the night, they come at 4:30 in the morning. One morning, I woke up early. It's like the call of prayer usually would wake me up, but it was 4:30. And it's like, what's that sound? And it was they were demolishing a house nearby. And then we did go and meet the family. And the Israelis, we had taken pictures. We didn't realize pictures of the neighborhood. And there was this house being built. And finally, they finished the house, and they were going to move into it the next week, and that's when they destroyed the house. So the Israelis sometimes will wait till you've spent all of your money and then demolish your house. And then you have to pay to clean up the demolished house. It's $30,000 to clean up the mess after your house has been destroyed. And some Palestinians would tell us they would hire a friend because they would do it for less than $30,000 to demolish and clean up their house. So what a tragedy. And it's in the shape, well, it has objects that are kind of personal effects from a house demolition, because when you see a house that's just been demolished, they don't let you take your things out. They just kind of, one time we saw news that they were just filling a house full of cement. They told the people they'd knock on the door, out of your house, and the trucks came and just filled the whole house full of cement. Like, that's just such a childish thing. I just couldn't believe seeing that.
When Dia's house was demolished, they had 5 minutes.
They had what?
They had 5 minutes to get out.
So another form of punishment. Everybody's worried that maybe tonight their house will be destroyed. So that's just an extra worry that everybody has to deal with. And then when you lose your house, you lose your insurance, you go live in a refugee camp. And then the shape of the key is in lots of cities. In the city center will be a sculpture of a key, and it represents the return.
So in 1948, 700,000 Palestinians were made homeless when the State of Israel was being established. So 700,000 were forced out of their homes, and many left with just their keys and expected, hoped to come back within 2 or 3 weeks, and now it's 60 some years.
And anyway, so that's a symbol of their hopefulness that maybe someday it will be better. And I truly believe that, and a lot of people go, this is just this age-old problem, how could it ever be solved? But I truly believe, like, as apartheid ended in South Africa, suddenly it ended, and those people have made amends, and they're living together and trying to move forward, and I truly believe it's possible. And the world depends on this. And so as people like you coming tonight to listen to this, maybe you already know these stories, but we need to share these stories. Look in the news. There's some lists of websites and alternative news sites to get updated stories.
George, you're important. In the Sabras.
Oh, in the Sabras. Yeah, there's a couple cactus leaves I made that also represent a piece of both for the Israelis and for Palestinians. But mostly when the Palestinian homes, villages were destroyed in 1948, what grew back were the cactus plants. So you can see where there used to be villages, there would be lots and lots of the Sabra cactus plants growing.
George, could you tell a story about the people, the group that's actually trying to stop the demolition?
Oh, yeah, sure. I can. There's a group of Israelis. Jeff Helper, he's written a couple books here, and actually there's one, this one is kind of his first book. Jeff Helper, and it's ICAD, Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And he's an Israeli Jew. He grew up in Minnesota, and he's lived in Israel for over 25 years, and his mission is to go and stand in the way of the bulldozers or chain himself up to a house that's scheduled, slated to be demolished. And sometimes there's one house they've rebuilt 6 times that's been demolished, and they rebuild it, and then the Israelis come and demolish it again. Anyway, so there, that's one example of, there are Israelis that are very unhappy with their government. And it's, that is important to know, that it's, the Israeli government is different than the religious part. It just happens to be called the country of Israel, which sometimes makes you think like it's a holy government, but the Jewish people are different than what the government, the state of Israel, is about, I think. And anyway, I just feel like, you know, everybody, there's lots of trouble in the world, but this is the birthplace of Christianity, and if we don't become more educated about it within probably 5 years from now, the Christian churches will become museums, and you could go as a tourist, but they won't have Christians worshiping Christians that live there. And Bethlehem will just become a settlement. It's, or maybe part of Israel. This, by the end of this year, Israel wants to annex all the illegal settlements in Palestine and become part of Israel. But while we were in Bethlehem, they took big chunks of land frequently, just chipping away, taking Bethlehem. And in a few more years, it will be all Israeli. So if you care about the birthplace of Christianity, we need to visit. It's the best thing to do. Palestinians just love to see anybody that cares. They feel forgotten and abandoned. And so I didn't think it was that important until I went there. It's like, yeah, why not? I'm a Christian, or I grew up a Christian, and so it's an important place for all of us to make a pilgrimage to. Yeah. I guess that's all. We'll let you go. It's taking a while, but
thank you.
Thanks.